And welcome to tonight's stream. You'll have noticed it's a return of the book club. And we've not had one of these for a while. It's not because we stopped wanting to do book reviews. I still want to do book reviews, and we've actually got some more lined up. But it gets to the point where you've done so many reviews, I'm not really sure, or wasn't really sure, where to go with the reviews. And you actually want to review books that people actually want to read. There's no point just reviewing books and having 10 people watching. And we have done some big books. However, this book is definitely worth reviving the book club for. And this book is something which, even before we get into it, I've got to say, I wholeheartedly recommend it. It's a really good book. So if you're watching tonight on Rumble and Odyssey, which is where we're live, please do share the link to this stream. Please share it to X, share it to Facebook, share it to places that we can't share it because we're banned. Because this is a stream that really needs to be listened to, because this is an excellent book. And I'm going to start out with a bit of a conclusion. This is a book every nationalist should have on their shelf. This is a book that everybody should have a copy of. It's that important. It's obviously Legal, Truthful, Guilty, Diary of a Political Prisoner by Sam Melia. We've got Sam with us tonight. We've got the usual panel back again as well. Now, obviously, the stream's going to be around, you know, an hour and a half to 2 hours. We've got a lot of things to discuss. And if you would like to help me out during the stream, please consider making a donation via either Entropy or Rumble. You can do that at any time, and any question attached to a donation will be put to either the panel, who have all read the book, or to the author, Sam Melia, who is with us this evening. So please share the stream, please make a donation, and please remember, I never ever put anything behind a paywall. So if you're watching this, it's free, everything I do is free, and I've now also got a completely free Substack where we'll be putting up regular writings twice per week. So that's on top of the three streams I do on my own channel, the two guest streams I regularly do, additional guest appearances. I will also be doing two Substack articles a week for the foreseeable future. So please make sure you support me on Substack as well. Anyway, let's get into it tonight. And we'll start by introducing, or just saying hi and reacquainting everybody with the panel. The first is you, Natty. How are you doing, my friend? Have you had a good weekend? And what were your first impressions of the book?
Well, I've got a very topical slice of life weekend, actually, because my wife went away last night and I had to deal with the children myself. I've got two very young children. I had to deal with them myself, which was strikingly similar to what Sam writes about in the book, being away from his family and some of the things that his family had to deal with while he was away inside under extremely spurious charges and state overreach. So I had a slice of just what it was like to live without the other half dealing with little children. So, you know, hopefully I helps me relate to the book just that little bit easier.
What would the how would you take the argument that Sam went to jail because he was a hero, whereas your wife basically had you sitting at home doing babysitting jobs because you're not a hero?
Like I said, I did, you know, I did say a very, very small slice of what she went through.
No, guys, you'll never hear me coming on a stream saying,
I'm the real hero here. I really went through it. So I don't want to sit here and pretend this is kind of Sam's triumphant return when I just had to have one night dealing with my two little children. Okay, it's much worse.
You see, sound just like Laura now. Who really suffered here?
And that's something you'll never hear me say, because I managed to maintain the leash on my woman. So I certainly won't be doing any of that overnight work. I'll be in my comfy bed.
Sure, sleep. Sure. Of course, mate, of course. And yeah, absolutely. You're absolutely true.
This is why
That's just because Mark's missus understands that Mark would just lace their dinner with Ambien and then be playing PUBG with us
PUBG
all
evening.
That's probably. I'm not admitting to anything. Right, we've also got Aunt Sally on the stream tonight. How are you doing? It's been a while since we've had you on. It's been a while since the last book review. How are you doing? And what are your initial impressions of the book?
Hi, everybody. I'm doing fine. What my initial impression? Oh, I loved it. I loved it. I mean, it's one of those books. I just couldn't put it down. I really couldn't. And every day was different. So and it's a different world. It's a completely different world to what you know. So you're reading about someone that you know personally, then one of the nicest guys who's been sent away, and just what he was going through every day, the regime, what they did to you, but also your thoughts along the way. It's fascinating. It's one, you know, people say, well, you would say that is Sam, but it really is a fantastic book. It's on out, you know, I've said that I've got favourite books of this. This is one of them. This is like... It's brilliant. Who knew you had that talent, Sam? You're really good at this. It's brilliant.
Oh, thank you.
It's just I couldn't put it down. It's like, I want to know what happens next. And, you know, I got involved with all the characters and all the people that came and went. And it's just a great book. Okay.
Well, I'll give my initial impressions of the book. I'm not somebody who really gets hooked on books very often. And having known Sam for a while, no offence, bro, but I didn't really think you had it in you. But it's an amazing book. I couldn't put it down. It's one of those books that I actually got lost in. It's very digestible, very readable. And my initial impressions of it are, or were, that once you pick it up, you won't be able to put it down. But not only is it a book that you won't be able to put down, if you do have a short attention span, it's written and presented in such a compelling way that you can digest it in bite-sized chunks if you want to. It is one of the best written, most digestible, most absorbing reads we've ever reviewed. And that's just my initial impression. So, Sam, we're going to throw it to you. You're obviously the author of the book, and... you started writing this, what was it, a day or the same, was it a day after or the same day that you actually went down? I mean, was the idea all along that if you got sent to prison to write a diary, or was it something you sort of committed yourself to as you were being taken to prison? Because the book starts with the way you felt sat there in that glass cage when they said, look, you're going down, it's 2 years, take him away. It starts there. That's where it begins. When did you decide to write it?
Well, it's just before sentencing when Mark said we were going to have a stream in about 2 years and 2 months. And we haven't got a guest. So if you can, deliver for us. When you arrive in prison, I got this tiny diary, like literally A7, A8, with a calendar in it. And so my first 3 days of entries are written in absolutely tiny script in this tiny diary. And then I came across a notebook and I was able to write longer form. And I think that was a couple days in. And then I took those three kind of really early entries saying like, oh, you know, I'm in with this guy. I think he's a spy, said. And I fleshed those out to my thoughts on the previous couple of days. And then from there, it became a way of differentiating the days because you are under the same kind of regime every day. And time just seems to... it is such a bizarre place that having a marker for what happened when seemed to make sense for me. And I had no intention of really publishing anything. But then I think when I got to Hull, there was a prison diary there. I think it's called A Little Bit of Porridge. And it's by a movie producer who got caught up in some sort of tax scandal. And he ended up doing it a few months inside. But like even this guy, I was gripped reading his prison diary while I was in prison, because I think he was down prison down south, and I was like, wow, this is entertaining. And if I'm finding it entertaining, I bet other people will find my diary entertaining. And from there, I kind of knew, it's like, okay, I'm probably going to publish this. And I wrote with that intention, that someone else would be reading it. It wouldn't just be for me. So when it came to actually, you know, typing the whole thing up, I didn't have to go back and, you know, over-explain things, because it was all inside knowledge for me personally. I was like, no, it's probably going to be read by someone, even if it's just my own daughters when they get older, or Laura when I get home. But someone will read this, so I'll format it in such a way that it is an entertaining read.
How much editorial work was done on it? Because Mark and Sal have alluded to this, but it has a really like gripping narrative flow, especially the first half of the book, where you're, you know, it's the kind of system shock of being sent to prison, when you kind of get the feeling you weren't really expecting to. You thought you were going to get a suspended sentence. Was there much editorialization, or is this just like a latent talent, or the kind of, because you kept a diary, it's so compelling to read it back?
I mean, don't want to be too not humble, but I guess it is a latent talent, because the only editorial I did was there was a few entries that had personal details about mine and Laura's relationship, and I was like, well, that's just for me. I just wrote that down, my feelings about some things and everything. It's like, that's not for general consumption. So I removed those. But my proofreader, who's a PA guy, he did a fantastic job in highlighting if there was anyone who just appeared out of nowhere, and I began talking about them as if people had previous knowledge, and it'd be like, this guy's just come out of nowhere. You know, who is he? How do you know him? And I'd be like, oh, right, okay. And there'd usually be an entry from a few days, few weeks before, where I've mentioned this guy, and I'd be like, right, I'll go back and actually put his name in there so that there's some continuity there. But generally, there was no additions to make it a more entertaining read after the fact. That, as you see it there, is as I wrote it while I was in my prison cell.
Amazing, amazing. It's really gripping. Like I said, it's really gripping. You know, when did it arrive? It arrived last week, and I've been on holiday last week, which you would have thought would have been a great time to read it, but just because of the children, I didn't really have much time. And then so I started Thursday or Friday, and I've barely been able to put it down. Just been tanking through it all of this weekend, and it's fantastic. It's really, really got a good flow to it.
I'm really pleased. A lot of the feedback I've received is people saying like just that, like I've cracked it out in 2 days and just like just really machined through it. But I think, like Mark said as well, being a diary format, there's no extensive chapters or anything like that. So if you want to just have it next to the toilet, you could you know, work your way through it like that as well.
Well, next to the prison toilet, you know, if it's well, the funny thing is,
the good thing about prison toilets is everything in your cell is still within reach. So,
including your cellmate.
Yeah, if you want to stroke his knee or something. Yeah, yeah.
The funny thing is, I've recently read The Count of Monte Cristo, and I read a while ago The Gulag Archipelago by Solzhenitsyn, but
oh yeah,
where both of the guys, you know, get incarcerated unfairly, I guess, broadly, but nothing, like neither of them captured like the despair and the kind of like the internal mental struggle of like those first few nights, that first initial like system shock. I that's such a good setup for the book. It's just amazing, and it just follows through. It's really incredible. So I don't know, kudos, just kudos on the writing style and the way you've presented it. It's brilliant, fantastic.
Yeah, I wanted to be as candid with how I felt as possible. I didn't want to kind of come out and have a prison diary where I was like, just chiefed it, mate, absolutely fine, you know. It's like, no, there was some pretty long kind of tortured nights and a lot of emotions going, and I wanted to put that forward as honestly as possible.
And just as an aside, have you relinquished your kind of your blubbering side since you've come out? Have you stopped crying at minor scenes in movies where you've
yeah.
Yeah,
thankfully that did kind of sort itself out pretty quick. So I think it was just the general heightened emotions of the situation. And then probably just a lot of stress, like underlying stress throughout the day. You're constantly worrying about the people around you, you know, potential threats and everything. So that when you are finally locked up at the end of the day, it's just like just a big sigh of relief where it's like, right, I'm finally alone now. You know, thankfully I did have a cell to myself for the most part, because of fears of me radicalizing my cellmates. So that is a rare kind of treat as far as prisoners go. Most of the guys in there, you are always with at least one other person at any other time.
Yeah, and you know, unless someone else wants to jump in, I'll just continue here. The really interesting thing is the first chapters when you go in, I felt the kind of the dread and the loneliness and the kind of fear of being in there that you put onto page, which was presumably what you were feeling. And then by the end of the book, where prisons, or just before you get let out into the AP, which is like the halfway house for those people listening, where you go before you're fully released and while you're still, you know, under probation. By the end of the book, before you get released, I was kind of along with you, where it's kind of mundane and there's a routine and it's kind of not pleasant exactly, but it's manageable, and it's just like you know, you've adapted to it and you've become the guy in prison who gets on with things, and it's not stressful and it's not frightening and whatever else. It's really effective at bringing you on that emotional journey.
Yeah, it really is quite a bizarre feeling. I think I say in the book that I'm kind of disturbed with how comfortable I am in there. And I think it's, you know, once you've done a certain amount of time, and it's like, especially like I was so well established on that H-wing by the end of it. And my friendship group were the ones who were kind of wielding that soft inmate power within the wing. It's like the new people coming in are the ones who are wary of you. Whereas, you know, yeah, cut back 10 months to me first appearing in Leeds. And it's like, you've got guys who have been on there for months. They're the ones who are well established. They're the ones who kind of manipulate the strings of soft power in there. And yeah, it's all just turned on its head, where you're like, I could see myself doing a lot of time here. And if it wasn't for the family, it wouldn't be that hard. Because in terms of your day to day, you've got your set routine. I've got my gym, I've got my exercise, I've got, you know, the servery job or whatever other work I'm doing on the wing. And I've got my friends, and, you know, people come and go and everything, but it is relatively easy. And the people in there who are saying, like, you know, well, this is, I'm not coming back to prison again, it's the family men. And it's usually people who have been in and out of prison all their lives, and they get into that kind of 30s, 40s, 50s or whatever. And they've, I mean, there was a guy in there with like 10 kids, ranging from late teens to like early years. And it's like, and he was like, yeah, this is the last time I'm coming in. Sadly, he was looking at a sentence of potentially years. So it's like, as far as your last time coming in goes, it's going to be a heavy one. But it's like the younger guys in there, they're just having the time of their lives, because they don't, it's essentially, it's like a holiday from the stress of their regular life. You know, they don't have to worry about getting the next bag or anything like that. It's just, they're in there hanging out. Drugs are freely available. So they're able to have a pretty good time in there.
Oh, sorry, I was muted. Yeah, I was going to say that, actually, that the family, so the guys who had families, and like, when you're talking about missing the kids, now I'm sure probably almost everyone listening to this understands this, but you could just maybe just touch on this, that you were sentenced just before your second child was born. And normally something like that would be grounds for the suspended sentence, which I think is probably part of the reason why you expected to get that, right? Because for almost any other crime, unless it was seriously violent or, you know, something really heinous, having a child on the way and having no previous convictions would have earned you that suspended sentence.
Yeah, because you do a pre-sentence report for the most part, and there was a month between my guilty verdict and the actual sentencing, and I had the meeting with probation and went over everything. And at the time I was employed, you know, I've already got one young kid, you know, family relies on my income. And then, yeah, like I say, another kid's on the way a month later. And the pre-sentence report did recommend no prison time because they're like, it isn't going to help. It's not an ongoing concern, his criminality. You know, he'd kind of retired the project. You've taken away his computer and everything else that he was using to do it, so he can't do it again. So they were like, prison, there's no point. You know, give him your license restrictions, your probation meetings and everything like that, and community service. And that's really the best way foot forward. However, what was it? I think Palestinian protesters, some of them had been making death threats to MPs, and because of some of the stickers, relating to Jewish power and Israel and these kind of things, the judge took it upon himself to kind of make an example of me, that political activists can't get away with these kind of things. So he put me away, but it was completely unexpected because it did just seem like suspended sentence made the most sense. It's like, I'm not a danger to the public, so you don't need to lock me up. And obviously there were so many reports at the time of overcrowded prisons and everything that, you know, really this guy who's put up a bunch of stickers, surely can't be worthy of taking up one of those prison spaces. And I mean, we've seen so many of these cases of, you know, rapists and stuff like that, where they're getting suspended sentences because, you know, the wife doesn't speak English, so she'll have a really hard time while he's away. So even though he's raped a 12-year-old, we're going to give you a suspended sentence so you can help your wife go shopping down the local Lidl. And it's like, okay, but this is the two-tier thing where we see the kind of difference in sentencing. You know, we've just seen that racially aggravated rape. Of a guy did it to a Sikh woman thinking she was Muslim, and he got something like a life sentence, whereas the people involved in these grooming gangs who are equally racially and religiously motivated, you know, referring to these white girls as, well, by white, so it's by definition it's racially motivated, are getting, you know, between 3 and 6 years for multiple counts of sexual assault.
Yeah, I think we'll probably get more into the kind of underlying ideology maybe a little bit later on, I guess. But I was going to ask you as well, I'm pretty sure I know the answer to this, but were you contacted by any, obviously you had your own legal representation, but were there any like human rights organizations or free speech legal people who got in touch with you and were taking up your case? Or because it was fairly high profile, I'm just wondering if there was anyone who wasn't moving in kind of whatever you call this, right-wing dissident circles, who took up your cause.
No one contacted me. No. Obviously I confronted the Free Speech Union. I think they had an event in Manchester. It was between me being found guilty and the actual me going away, and I attended the meeting and put it directly to Toby Young, and said that it's like, you know, you guys didn't offer me any help beforehand. Now that I've been found guilty of legal, truthful stickers, it's like, is there anything you can do? And they were like, well, no, you've been, now that you've been found guilty, we can't really do anything for you. And it's like, oh, thanks. You know, it's like, you refused to help me beforehand. And now that I have been found guilty, you don't want anything to do with me. And then since coming out, there's been no interest at all from, you know, any of these free speech organizations or anything like that. It's, you know, there's been the odd article here and there, but yeah, there's been no invitations for help or anything like that.
I'm sure you know this. I'm sure you're aware of this, but 99% of free speech activists and free speech advocates and free speech organizations suddenly wilt and don't want anything to do with you when you start critiquing Jewish overrepresentation, Jewish power, which is why Toby Young, I think, was just, you know, kept you at arm's length and barely said a word about your political persecution.
Yeah, these free speech orgs, they seem to like, they're kind of like ideal situation is like when some, I think the one the FSU was always kind of really promoting was some, she was like a lesbian football fan who had put some like anti-trans stuff on her social media, and the local football club had banned her from their stadium, and they were like, this is beyond the pale. And it's just like, Jesus Christ, guys, this is like the lowest hanging fruit you could possibly chase after, but that's their bread and butter. And it's like, really, it is kind of, it's that always, kind of I always classic liberal thing.
Yeah, just another arm of like counter jihad, the kind of intellectual arm of the counter jihad to counterweight Tommy Robinson and the kind of street level counter jihad. You have Toby Young and Douglas Murray on the other end decrying free speech is under attack because we can't criticize Muslims.
Yeah, and they'll fight the case of someone who's just like some Jewish guy who's like burning Qurans outside the Iranian embassy. Like, yeah. Great, yeah, really taking the fight to power there, guys.
No, that's just to bring it back though. That's, I mean, it's expected, but this country, I've heard it said recently, and it's been known that human rights lawyers are one of the elite groups in this country who ensure that the worst scum who don't belong here get to stay here and continue committing crimes against the native population. So it's hardly surprising that they wouldn't take up your case, but it's, you know, I guess we needed to hear it. I'll pass it back anyway, because I've been speaking for ages now, so if anyone else wants to get in.
You know what, it's a really mundane, stupid question, but I've got so many women's questions. Things like, you know, you said you didn't get clean sheets, and all your sheets didn't go to the laundry, and you're wearing your same clothes. And I always had this vision of people that went into prison were handed a set of clothes, and it's and that all your sheets would go to the laundry. And it didn't make any sense. Like, how does that, as a woman reading the book, I'm thinking like, well, how does that work, that you get clothes brought in? One day you said you're wearing the same, your double days on socks and underpants, and I know it's a stupid question.
And then he went to prison and it got even worse.
But yeah, it's like, why was that? How did that work? Like, do you get issued prison clothes when you go in, or you have to take in your own clothes, or what? Don't spend too long on this. I know it's a stupid question.
No, it's in British prisons, you are allowed to wear your own clothes. However, when I packed my bag for sentencing, I was doing it as more of like a formality, because I was like, well, it's a recommended suspended sentence. We all think we're going to get a suspended sentence. And really, the only person who was saying you are definitely going to jail was Joe Marsh, who always keeps it real. And he was like, no, you're definitely going down.
There was someone else who said you were definitely going down, mate, who's on this stream tonight.
Were you?
Yeah, I spoke to Laura, and I said to Laura, Laura said, "Oh, we think we're going to get
told
suspended."
Me, couldn't you?
No, Laura wrong me. Like,
to me, you were like, "Oh, mate, you're going to be fine. Don't worry about it." To Laura, it's like, "Yeah, mate, he's gone."
I'm going to back Mark up here, because I remember talking to you the night before the sentencing, and Mark was like, "Look, I've warned him that it might not go the way he thinks it's going to go." So I think I'm agreeing with Mark here.
I was definitely
one of them. And I remember saying to Laura, he's definitely going down. And she said, well, how can you say that? And I said, well, look, I said, this is the way you've got to think about it.
Crying down the phone, how can you say that?
Well, she was. She was very upset. She was like, how can you say this? And I said, well, if you plan for him going away and he doesn't, we've got a massive win on our hands. However, if you plan for him being out and he goes down, it's going to be catastrophic. And I said, look, you really do need, I said, you know, everything in this trial, I said, has gone against Sam, even when he's done everything right. And I'm not saying this because I want bad for you. I'm saying this because I don't want you guys to, you know, Sam to sashay in there in the morning, you know what I mean, in his suit, you know, with a little sort of victory speech to read out on the steps when he comes out, you know, I'll never be silenced, except, and then, you know, they drag him away because the judge changes his mind at the last minute.
End up having to use the victory speech for toilet paper.
Yeah, and lo and behold, that happened. And I genuinely thought during the trial you did really well, and I've said this on streams. And look, I'm not saying you're not intelligent, because you are, but you're not. There's some people who are natural debaters or sort of academic types. And when you're in court, you are dealing with somebody who is a debater, an academic, who's essentially paid to put normal people away. And that's why court's so unfair. But I thought you did amazingly well on the stand. And I thought you presented enough compelling arguments for there to be no way on earth for them to send you down. I thought, at worst case scenario, it's going to be a hung jury and they'll give you a retrial. And when they sent you down, I was as shocked as anyone. And I'm still to this day, don't know what went on in that jury room for you. I mean, you probably spent hours theorizing because it was you who bore the brunt of it. But once they had found you guilty, I was like, they are going to do it's bad. Now it's going to be open season, because there's no way as a judge going to look at you and say, well, you know, I like that. I like this guy. And even if he does like you, and even if he did have sympathies for you, he wouldn't be able to admit that. And at that point, I was like, you're going to be screwed here, mate. And I remember saying that to Laura, and she was of a different mindset. But I didn't usually, you know me, I'm quite obnoxious, to say the least.
No, mate, don't say that about yourself. Come on.
I am quite. I mean, look, I am. But the thing is, I like to push my point on people. And if I think I'm right, you know me, I'll be like, look, we have to go down this route. And, you know, I'm right. You've got to listen to me, accept what I say, because I know I'm right. But in this case, I wasn't going to be to your missus like, look, shut up, you daft cow. He's going down, you know, get real. Because it was bad enough as it was. So I put over my side in like a very unmark call it fashion to not cause like you guys to be even, you know, feeling even worse than you were. But, you know, I was just like, well, now they've gone this far, they're going to go the whole hog. And when you went down, I'll be honest, you know, I thought you dealt with it really well. You were very stoic. You stiff upper lip. You did really well. Then obviously, as we found out in the book, you became a dribbling boob roughly 5 minutes afterwards. And, you know, and for the rest of, I think, you know, when you put those little post-it notes in the book, right? My book is just full of post-it notes, but each one is every time you admit to crying, think about crying, do cry. It's like twice as thick as it was before because we're blubbing. It's
like a tally of tears.
I was sat watching the Christmas movie. It was The Grinch. And when the little girl said she didn't think she was going to get a present that year, I was the only one on the wing in inconsolable tears. And I went
that,
back to...
That gives me far more credit than I deserve. I was crying to Mamma Mia and like literally TV adverts.
I was with you until you said you were crying at Mamma Mia. And then I was like, is this
It's like Sam is the opposite of me. I'm sort of like this cold. Sam points out in the book, I'm like this cold automaton that doesn't take any nonsense or have any emotion whatsoever. Whereas Sam is like my counterfoil. But anything reduces him to tears.
but to get back to Sally's question.
Yeah, sorry. I was just saying, I did say that. And like, but when they sent you down, I've got to just add, right, I don't show my emotion. But my level of rage was gamer rage, and I could have absolutely gone berserk in that court. And in fact, when we came out, there was some discussion about whether the sentence was too harsh or whether the and I just exploded and was like, the jury was bent, the whole thing's a joke. And somebody said, I'm not going to mention who, was like, well, I don't think it's quite that bad, Mark. And Laura had to sort of like pull me back and was just like, it's not the time, Mark. And I mean, the steam was coming out of my ears. I was so angry because I thought it was so unfair.
Can you just before we move on, because we're talking about the jury and I did want to bring this up. Can you just tell us again what the makeup of the jury was? Because this is quite interesting. And I thought when I read it, because I obviously, you know, I knew what happened, but I was surprised to hear there were like three or four working class. I don't know. I think you described them as like tradesmen, working class, white guys on there.
Yeah. Let me just quickly finish Sally's question. So I packed two of everything, not thinking I was really going away. And then when you get there, you're issued with a T-shirt, a top, pair of socks, pair of boxers, and a pair of bottoms, just one of each, and that's it. So basically I had three changes of clothes, and one of them was the prison kind of garb. But then it's also, it's so cold in your cell that you're sleeping fully clothed as well. The blanket that they give you, it's not a blanket, it's more like a throw, like a kind of knitted throw with just holes in it. You end up having to try and acquire a second one of those in order to make it worth anything. But for the longest time, probably a couple of weeks until you can process a clothes order form where you can ask someone to bring things on a visit and they will then be issued to you like a week or two afterwards once they've been checked, you're stuck with whatever you've got there. I was just stuck with three pairs of clothes, and you know, regards to the washing, you know, if it's full by the time you take your stuff down there, the wash guy will just be like, I can't do it, and you'll be like, all right then. You know, later on in prison, when you've built relationships, they'll go, don't worry, I'll get it in after these guys, I'll boot this guy or whatever. But when I was initially there in Leeds, it was kind of I didn't even have a change of shoes, it was just pretty rough going for the first couple of weeks there, until I managed to get Laura to send in a bunch of my clothes and a few other things that she bought to top me up. So that's how it works. And then Natty, the jury, there was, what is it? I think there were three non-whites. There was an African who still had a heavy African accent. There was a guy who, I think by his name, he sounded kind of Egyptian. I can't remember what his name was. And then there was a Pakistani guy who I just dubbed Taxi Driver. There was three or four white guys who just seemed like regular people on the street. And I thought they might, you know, especially there was one older one in his like 50s, looked like a laborer. And I was like, all right, he's probably going to be sound. But I think it was one of my friends who came to enter the trial was at the bus stop with him. And I think he said he overheard that he's got like a mixed race kid or grandchild or something. So, you know, you can't go based on looks alone. And even if they were regular people who have a bit of common sense about them, when faced with a non-white person saying, nah, he's racist, how many people are really equipped to counter that argument? And are willing to go to the mat for another white person to express legal views? I don't think there's many among them. You know, I mean, that's kind of how we got into this, you know, trouble in the first place, is the fact that no one's willing to stand up and just be like, nah, we're not doing that. You know, this isn't good for white people, so we're not going to do it. Instead, it's just been, you know, various non-whites going like, oh, this isn't very nice for us. And everyone's just bent over backwards for them. And then we've ended up here, you know, facing demographic annihilation.
Yeah, it was depressing to hear, because I guess, you know, being in the trenches of this thing and kind of aware of what's going on politically, you kind of imagine that one of your fellow countrymen sitting through a trial like this and would kind of get the understanding, and this is going to lead on to the next question, but this is like a political case and you are being tried as a political prisoner in everything but name, you know, or almost admittedly in, you know, as a political trial. Was your legal team, and there's probably a few Americans watching here who The legal system in this country is a little bit different, and the court system is a little bit different. Was your legal representative allowed to make the case that this was political persecution? Or was that, or would the judge just have slapped that down? You know, in his closing statements or in his conclusion, would be able to say to the jury, you know, there are people who've committed this, you know, crime in air quotes, who have not been here, and it's only because of your politics that you're standing in front of a jury.
I think that would count as kind of like them contempt of court kind of thing, where it's like they don't question the validity of a prosecution in and of itself. The best he could do was kind of make a case for me. And I know at the time as well, you agreed with me, Mark, that the closing statement from my defense was fantastic. And he basically did all but call them out as an overreaching state agents in this regard. But from the stand, I made the point multiple times that this was complete state overreach, and there's absolutely no grounds for me to be here. You know, it's been admitted that this is legal, you know, extreme but lawful was the exact words. And in terms of the truth, the jury were advised by the prosecution to ignore the fact that they were truthful. So that was never on the table as part of our defense, but to be honest, in the stand, I wish I'd hammered it even more than I did, rather than answering in good faith or whatever. I was going to go down. Be belligerent as hell and just really go after the state, the prosecution, the counterterrorism and everything, and really, really go down swinging.
I bet there must have been quite a few kind of 3 o'clock in the morning, can't sleep. Thought processes where you were like, I wish I would have said this. I wish I would have said that to him.
Oh my God. Yes. Yeah. So much kind of like, what do they call it? Staircase wit and everything. We kind of like, oh, this
Monday morning quarterbacking.
Yeah. So much of that. And especially, you know, as soon as that guilty verdict came back, and it was kind of like, oh, I shouldn't have even bothered trying. It's like, I should have just had put out some really, really fire stuff for the court reporters to be quoting in the news stories and stuff like that. But as it was, it's like, no, I thought I could genuinely, I could do a Mark Collett and go up on these charges and walk away scot-free and be shaking the champagne outside the courtroom, but was not to be.
Can I just ask Mark a question here? Was there a bottle of champagne on standby for a non-custodial sentence?
No, there wasn't. Do you know why? It was so when I was on trial, it was a really, really difficult time for me. And I understand what Sam went through. I would say for Sam, in some ways, it'll have been a lot harder for Sam. And in some ways, it'll have been easier for Sam. So it'll have been easier for Sam in the way that he had Laura and was in, like, you know, you've got that marital block, you know, you've got everything sorted out. Like with me, you know, I had a girlfriend at the time. She's a lovely girl. But like, if I'd have gone down, she wouldn't be able to keep my place going. You know what I mean? You'd have been worrying about, well, who's going to clean my place out? What's going to happen? What's going to happen to all my stuff? You know, am I, you know, when I come out, you know, is it all just going to be trashed and thrown somewhere? You know, who's going to look after everything? Whereas Sam had that going.
All your SNES games could have been opened. That's what I
they could have been. That's what I mean. Like, you know, all my SNES games opened, you know, everything just ruined. My life would have been over. On a serious note, Sam did have that incredible sort of backing of like a wife, children, stability. But at the same time, so that was a good thing. But I think for Sam as well, the bad thing with Sam, or thing that would have made it harder for Sam, is in a way that makes it easier, but in a way that also makes it harder because you're leaving so much behind. Whereas I was a younger guy, so it was kind of like, well, I'm a young guy, who cares? A couple of years in prison at the age of 24, 25, it's different when you're older and you're missing something like the birth of a child. I will say this though, Sam. one of the things I loved about the book, and there's so many of things I love about the book, but I love your transition. You go into prison and your personality really, really comes through in that you are such a nice, caring guy. And I know we've joked tonight a little bit about things, but you are a really lovely, nice, caring guy that everyone gets on with. Much more so than, say, somebody like me. I can be quite difficult to get on with. Whereas, you know, personal spaces, whereas you're not, you know, everyone likes you. And I think that really comes over in the book. But as the book progresses and as you get on with people in prison and as everything sort of as you're sort of getting to know people, you become a bit of a prison hero. And as time goes by, it's interesting to read that sort of section of the book where you sort of say, who am I becoming? Because you start to sort of get on so well with people in prison that you actually think, do I want to be like these people? And I thought that was a really interesting part as well. This idea that, like, you can go into an institution like that and you can end up coming out being something that you don't necessarily want to be. I found that really, really interesting, a real compelling part of your journey. I don't know if you want to say anything about that, but you really did go from being like this guy who's obviously not a criminal in any way, a complete outsider to the prison world, but ended up being somebody that in prison got on with everybody. And, you know, I'm not saying it's the Shawshank Redemption, but you were a bit of an Andy Dufresne character in that you went in there as a non-criminal, but ended up being loved by everyone and being a real cog in the machine in there that everyone had only good things to say about.
Yeah, it's part of that disturbing kind of change I noticed in myself towards the end was that, like, when you first come in, there's so many tragic stories and people in such a kind of in such dire straits while they're in there that you want to, or at least I wanted to, help people as best I could. And then over the months, over the weeks and months, and everything, you're burned by them, or they clearly have no desire to change. You realize that you just can't help some people. And by the end of it, it's like these tragic characters who, when I first came in, I would identify with, because it's like, oh, I'm in a tragic situation or whatever. And it's like, by the end of it, you're in with the guys who are quite comfortable in there, and they just have no time for these kind of down and outers, and you have no time for them either. And you'll laugh at misfortune and people's pain and stuff like that. And it's like that's someone who I never wanted to become, but I could definitely feel myself trending in that direction towards the end. So I was glad that it was such a short sentence, because it's like it was hardening me in ways that I didn't want to be hardened. It's a weird thing, but coming out and being able to reunite with my family and realize that it's like, right, that wasn't a permanent shift, it was more a kind of coping mechanism to deal with the situation that I was in, was a huge relief. Because I was really worried that it's like, God, has this changed me to being, you know, the person who, you know, like you say, people like, and everything. And it's like, am I going to be coming out and being the kind of just a bit of a dick? And it's like, and thankfully that wasn't a kind of permanent shift. But it's also such a different environment where it's like out in the real world, you don't come across so many of these down and out tragic characters in such a concentration, because and then those kind of people become unique, and they can be helped and things like that. Whereas inside, so many of them are like that, and you're just the newest person who they want to spill their guts to, and really they're not looking for a solution, because this is their life, and in a way they kind of wallow in it. But yeah, by the end of it, I was a kind of product of my environment and the people who I was hanging around with. And, you know, so many, I mean, they're just career criminals. You know, they make their livelihood out of the suffering of others in terms of the drug dealers and everything. And then there's the people who physically attack others and don't feel any remorse about it. And it's like, that's who I was surrounding myself with. And now, thankfully, now that I'm back out, I don't have to associate with these people. And I've kind of gone back to being the normal kind of Sam who I was before, thankfully.
Sam, what about the guy that you liked, the posh guy, the one that was...
Oh, yeah, Jason.
Yeah, yeah. Well, did you keep in contact with him?
Yeah, yeah, we spoke a little while ago. He basically left the country because he had the financial ability to do so. He's got a house in another country, and basically said he didn't like the way Britain's going, so he just up and left. So he now lives abroad. But yeah, we've kept in touch, and I mean, similar kind of thing where it's like someone we knew in there who was who we were friends with. And then when we got out, he got out and ended up somehow getting himself like $5,000 in debt or something to some nefarious people. And he was hitting up Jason being like, oh, mate, can I get some money? And Jason was like, no, I'm not just giving you $5,000. And it's like, and the guy would just turned on him, just really, really nasty to him. And that's the kind of people you met in prison where they're nice to you as long as they think they can get something out of you. But as soon as, you know, you're not willing to do so, then it's like they'll turn into every other, you know, piece of shit who's in there. But yeah, Jason's doing really well for himself now. I suppose he always was. I mean, he was doing million pound land deals while he was inside, so can't have been too bad. But yeah, we got along really well, mainly just because he was someone I could have an intelligent conversation with for the most part, and we were mentally pretty normal. You know, I didn't have to worry about him having some schizophrenic break at the other end of the cell while I was sleeping, you know. Whereas I had some cellmates where I was kind of like, okay, this you seem to be really kind of walking the tightrope of sanity here, so it's like, hopefully this doesn't go south for me.
Oh, and when you, just another woman's question, but when you shit, you've got a toilet in the cell where there's two of you, and is there no privacy? Like, there's not even a curtain around the toilet?
The first cell I had had a curtain. Second one didn't.
Just a curtain? And you have to eat in there as well?
Yeah, yeah, yeah. You eat in there as well. Generally, it's like kind of good manners to you wait until like association and you let your pad mate leave, you know, if you need to take a dump. But the modern cells over in Hull, they don't even have a curtain. They have like a kind of half wall so that if you're sat down, you can just see, like you can look over it. So you could continue a conversation with your pad mate if you were so inclined. And in that case, the etiquette is to basically turn around on your bunk so you're not literally making eye contact with the person doing a number two. It's really intense.
How do they get away, like, with hygiene rules? Like, you're not allowed to have a toilet anywhere near the where you're cooking food in a cafe and things like that. And I just, like, the hygiene of it.
You're not cooking food in there.
No, but you're eating in there.
Yeah, yeah, you are eating in there. I guess they have to relax standards somewhat because just the realities of a prison cell don't allow you to have separate rooms and things like that. Because, basically your entire cell has to be visible through the tiny window slit so the officer can look through and be able to see you. You can't hide in there, you know, waiting with a weapon or anything. So that kind of dictates how things work. But I think generally hygiene regulations are pretty lax outside of the actual kitchen. Surgery as well had some hygiene rules, but they were never enforced or anything. You know, certain mops for certain things and everything like that. That was all pretty lax. And yeah, showers were just an absolute state, insects all over them and everything. But I mean, that's what we see when they do the inspection of these prisons is generally they're all found wanting in terms of these things. But yeah, when it comes to sharing a cell, you become very well acquainted with the other person, and very comfortable. I mean, you know, you're having conversations with your wife, girlfriend, partner, whatever, you know, within full earshot of the other person. So there's really nothing that's hidden between the two of you.
Yeah, thanks for clarifying. It was just something I really wondered. I'm thinking, how does that work? I don't know how that would work with women, to be honest, because women are a lot fussier.
But I suppose I don't know what the state of women's prisons is. I don't know if they all have solo cells or something. So generally you could start
putting stickers up and find out if you wanted to. I mean,
I've got about 300 stickers if you want to want to dip your toe in the water.
No, you're all right. I did wonder that as I'm reading, but thinking, how does it work? What do they do? And just stupid things I don't know how I'd cope with that. Like, how would I get my head around that someone else is watching you take a dump? If you had etiquette where you turn away, that makes sense. What's the other? I did have a question. I'm going to get in there before Natty. But with the diary and constant moving cells, and you know, where you were just suddenly moved from with very short notice, and how comes? I'm surprised that you managed to keep the whole thing and that it didn't get taken off, like lost by the authorities on purpose, kind of thing. Because I knew you were writing it, and they weren't happy about it, were they?
Well, Stal, there's this thing called a prison pouch that you. No, I'm joking.
it was a big notebook, but we got it up there.
Rolled it up.
I mean, when you're transferring cells, or whatever, they do search you, but what they're really looking for is various weapons, contraband, and stuff like that, and. I mean, there's not many people in there with books, let alone notebooks. So they didn't attract the attention of your average guard when moving cells. And there was only one time the diary got taken away, and it was when I was taken to segregation, and it was acquired by the prison staff. Basically, it's like an intel resource, hoping. And that was something that I always made sure to leave out of any details of the day. Was kind of like, right, I know this guy's dealing from this cell or anything like that. I didn't want anything like that. And that's what a lot of the questions, if other prisoners found out that I was keeping a diary, that was looked upon with suspicion, and questions were asked. It's like, well, you're not talking about this, are you? And I was like, no, don't worry about that. And they're like, all right, okay. You know, so there's a lot of people who showed up in the diary who had, you know, contraband iPhones and things like that. And it's like, that's never included because I knew it could always get read. And I didn't want anyone getting in trouble because of it. In the end, I think the only people who got in trouble because of the content of my diary was some of the officers when they did read it for intel. And I'd made mention of, it's like, oh, I had a very pleasant political conversation with the officers on this wing or whatever. And they'd be like, oh, shut the fuck up. I knew it was going to be important to me, even if it was just to pass to the kids. So I made absolutely sure that was always kept well in sight and was never going to get lost between a cell move. I mean, you know, you don't have too much stuff in prison, so it's not like you're going to be leaving much behind. You know, you just bag everything up and move where you get told to move to.
No, I just had this thought that they could, if they'd wanted to, they could have.
I know there's other political prisoners who are facing longer sentences, and they have had their writings confiscated whenever found. I know it does happen, but you know, maybe it depends on your charge as well, and whether they can justify like taking whatever you write down away from you because of whatever charge you've been put in there on.
I want to add something to all this, because one thing that really did come out as well in the book is you're sort of having this battle when you're in there where you want to be liked. You want to be liked by the people who are, you know, sort of strong people who get on with things. You don't want to be in the milieu with the freaks and the drug addicts and the losers. But there was this undercurrent the actual popular sort of strong, more upstanding people in there. And when I say upstanding, I meant not really upstanding, that's the wrong word. People who could stand on their own two feet, defend themselves, people you could actually have a conversation with and weren't addicts or complete weirdos. They tend to actually be the hardened criminals. And it comes over in there that if you want to be in the in-group, you tend to be someone who picks on the out-group. So there's this clear pecking order from the lowest of the low, who are obviously the paedophiles, the sex offenders. Then you have, you know, your addicts, the people who owe debt, the weak, the strange, the physically odd. And then you get to sort of the healthy, the strong, the people who are chatty, the people who understand life. And they tend to prey on the weak. And in the book, you obviously become somebody who's very, very well liked on your wing. Everywhere you go, you're liked. You were liked in Hull, you were liked in Leeds, and no matter which wing you're on, you're a popular guy. But you never become one of the bullies. And it really, really shines through in the book. And there's several things I've got to say about you, mate, that really came over well. The first was that everywhere was a tip, like bugs in the showers. And you were like, I'm not having this. If they're putting me on cleaning, I'm going to make the showers clean for whoever uses them. The next was when you got put on the duty of cleaning up people's cells or cleaning the cells so that new people would come in and get a nice clean cell. You said, look, it's really scary going into prison. A lot of things can get you down. So the least I can do is make sure everyone comes into a nice clean cell. That was really, really lovely. And the best bit was when you were on the servery, you got to the point where you were such a top boy. Everyone liked you and everyone trusted you. You were basically head of the servery, which is the best job in the prison. But you quit the job because you couldn't stand the lads stealing and depriving other prisoners of food, because they were all sort of pinching anything they could get their hands on, which meant the weaker and sort of more easily preyed upon prisoners didn't get the right amount of food, which is unfair. And you were like, well, if I speak out about this, I'm going to be a pariah. If I do this and I'm part of this, I can't live with myself. So I'm just going to walk away from the best job. And it's amazing that the people who viewed you in prison doing that had more respect for you because of the way you did it. And I just wanted to raise that you do come across throughout it all as a guy who probably could have been sort of the top guy on the prison and really preyed upon others. But instead, you went out of your way to make life better for everybody that you came across. And it really came over in the book that the prison was actually a better place because you were in there. And I know you don't want to go back, and I know that you're not going to be going back. And I know that, you know, the prison is somewhere that you want to stay away from, but you did make life better for everyone. And I think that's really, really good. Now, I know this isn't about Sven, but Sven did the same when he was in prison, teaching people to read, helping people out, teaching people life skills. And I just think that really needs to be stated. There is this real sort of, again, Andy Dufresne from The Shawshank Redemption vibe about the book, how you made everyone's life better. And that started even when you first got in there, because they put you in charge of a store cupboard and you were like, this is a mess. No one can find everything in here. How can anyone run a store cupboard like this? And the first thing you did was put everything in its place so that people coming to the store cupboard could actually get what they needed. And I don't know, mate, you just come over as a really good guy. I don't know if you've got any sort of recollections you want to share with us. It's not really a question. It was just something I picked up. And then obviously we'll go around the group and people can keep chirping in with things. But that was just something I wanted to raise.
Can I just break in? Because I actually made notes about that section because I found it really insightful. And it's almost like a pivotal moment where you're in the servery. And I annotated this and I put some notes beside it. But I'm just going to read it out. Okay, so Mark's described a situation where you're in the servery and there's the guys above you are basically pinching food to give to their mates or hoard it or whatever. And it brings forth this kind of moral conflict in you where these are the guys with the soft power and you're in a good cushy position. But also, like, most of the wing is suffering from you know, not getting the little snacks and treats that they would get because of being pinched. And you say this, to try and rein it in as an inmate, as in, you know, to rein in the bad behavior, is to invite trouble upon yourself and in no way worth it. Because while you may get the appreciation of the large part of the wing, you receive no backup should anyone take issue with you. You'd basically be making friends of drug addicts and the meek while making enemies of the most violent and capable. I thought that was a really insightful, like, end to a paragraph there. That's why I made a note about it. I thought it was like a turning point in the book, or a turning point in maybe not a turning point, but a really like strong redoubt, like a character moment in the book.
Yeah, thank you. It was a really tough moment, that, because like I say, it's like potentially I'm making enemies of some really kind of really bad characters. I mean, the guy who ran the server, he was in for murder. So it's like, this is someone who is willing to enact violence. And he was someone who also lent out vapes and, you know, if people got into too much debt would, you know, enact violence upon them as well. So this is someone who's kind of free and easy with his hands. And it was something where I was like, but I can't do this. It's like every time I was leaving the servery, I felt like, despite not doing it myself, I felt like I was a piece of shit because I was just allowing it to happen right next to me, and doing nothing to stop it. So, and obviously actively doing something to stop it would have only meant negative consequences for myself. And the hard power of the prison, you know, the officers, they were allowing this to go on right under their noses as well, with full knowledge. So there was no kind of like appeal to authority and that sort it out, you know, run to teacher kind of thing, you know. So it was kind of like, well, the only thing I can do is make a stand for myself, and hopefully kind of set an example. And I think it did somewhat, because the server guys did ask me, like, oh, you've quit, you know, what's up with that? Because no one quits servery ever. You know, you have to be prized off there with a crowbar once you get on there. And I explained it to him, and I was like, listen, you know, basically the way I'm getting through prison is by willful ignorance of just how bad some of people in here are and the kind of things they're doing. So I can only stretch that so far. You know, I can be friendly with the guy who's, you know, basically extorting people on vapes and drugs and stuff like that. But it's like, I don't want to know exactly what you're doing. And I'm just going to kind of turn away from it. Whereas this, I was involved in it, so I had to step back. And like you said, yeah, they did respect me for doing that, which wasn't what I was expecting. You know, I was expecting them to be like, oh, he's a soft lad or anything like that. It's like, they were like, oh, you know, fair play to you, you know. But then part of that was also recognizing that they knew what I was in for and that I was basically a civilian. You know, I wasn't in there for armed robbery or something like that. So it would be, you know, basically just be really two-faced for me to be like, I'm making a moral stand. Meanwhile, in the outside world, I've been like, you know, knocking over corner shops with a shotgun or anything. You know, they understood that I wasn't really one of them. So they respected me taking a step back. And there are a number of times where people who I considered friends were in there, and it's like, and then I'd hear that it's like, oh, they lent out to someone, they owed them, and they basically beat them up in the cell. And I'm like, that's not the guy I know, but in a way it's because I don't want to know it, you know, but that person, that is who he is. You know, he's not like that with me, but it's like, he is a kind of a bad character. And that's kind of how you have to get through it. And especially at the start, when I came in, I was the person on the receiving end of the servery, you know, completely fleecing the wing. You know, if there'd be times where you'd be the last kind of landing called down for dinner, and it'd be like, you get your main meal and that's it. And it's like, oh, what about the pack of the crisps, the chocolate bar, whatever? And they're like, oh, we've run out. And at first I was kind of like, oh, it's weird that they don't give you enough. then quickly found out that it's like, oh, you guys literally just hoard all this and or give doubles, triples to your friends. But, you know, from the first time I got on servery at the kind of lowest level, you're giving the breakfast packs, you know, which is like a little 30-gram bag of cereal, packet of milk. And you'd have the kind of guys who are the dealers on the wing coming through, and they'd be like, oh, hook us up, mate, hook us up. And I'm like, I'm, you know, I'm not friends with you. I don't know you, really. And they're like, oh, hook us up. And I was just like, no, it's one each. And they'd be like, you know, kicking off. And there was always a worry that it's like, is someone going to really take offense to this? And thankfully no one did. But I think that's also partly due to my stature at 6'2" and, you know, at the time, 17, 18 stone or whatever. It's like, yeah, probably not the easiest target for that kind of thing. But there's, you're in such a negative environment that really you do. I wanted to make any little stand that I could, you know, whether it was just taking on cleaning to the nth degree beyond what anyone else was, purely because it's like, no one else is doing this. Someone's got to do this. And this is how things fall apart, is if everyone goes, someone else's job. It's like, no, someone's got to be the first one to step up to these things. And I like to think I'm that guy here on the out as well, where it's like, if there's a problem, I will try and solve it as best I can. And taking that to the inside, where everyone's hands off, no one wants anything to do with anything, no one wants to put in any effort. You very quickly kind of make a name for yourself as someone who's a kind of good guy, who's trying to make positive changes. And despite the fact that no one else is really engaging in that, everyone kind of appreciates it. And I suppose it's that kind of thing with society as a whole, where, you know, not everyone wants to be a bin man. However, you know, everyone appreciates the bins being taken out and respects bin men, you know? So yeah, it's just one. There are a few of those moments inside where it's kind of like and I suppose the diary helped with that as well. The fact that I was cataloguing everything meant that it's like, if I bottled it and just went, oh, I'll keep my head down, I won't say anything. And it's like, well, you know, my kid's going to read about that. You know, Laura's going to read about that. And as it turns out, a hell of a lot of people could have read about that. So it's like, it would have been very embarrassing. So that helped with keeping me accountable. That was like, I am writing down exactly what I'm doing, and I suppose that means that I can't allow myself to forget about these things. And if I do make a negative moral choice, I'm gonna write it down and I'm gonna hold myself accountable to it. And thankfully, I didn't have to do that at any point.
The interesting part of that is that it's what's not written in the book explicitly, but comes through in your political musings in the book as well, is that your that kind of mindset where you take responsibility for the whole in prison, you know, the population of a prison, the area you're in, the kind of population around you, is one of the reasons, or the reason, you also take responsibility for the society you found, you know, you've grown up in and has given you a life and a family and all the rest of it, despite the fact that it's unpopular and you've suffered for it. And you know, there's a myriad of small things or bad things that will happen to you for being that way and taking responsibility in the way you are. And I think sets a really good example for nationalists and for people who do find themselves on kind of our side of the tracks. Because for a guy like you, you're doing it for the right reasons. And if you read this book, it's clear to see that the same mindset that led you to be a nationalist and to care about your people and your country and your, you know, your community is the same mindset that you took into prison that made you a useful and a helpful and a positive man in prison. And I think it's really, you set a good example.
Oh, thank you, man. Yeah, I mean, that's what I try to do, you know, for the, you know, the nationalist scene as well as just for a family as well. It's like, we should always be trying to set the best example and a kind of pro-social example. you know, that's that again is why we've reached this kind of state here. Where it's like everyone, nobody feels accountable to the society they're in. So they don't do small positive changes in the local area because, you know, that's someone else's responsibility. And it's like, no, I think if we all engaged a bit more and went like, oh, that's something I can fix, then we'd be looking at a much better space. I mean, we see it, you know, within the nationalist scene as well. It's kind of like everyone's got an opinion on what people are doing. But when it comes to, you know, when you ask around, it's like, all right, anyone want to come do this? You know, there's usually you found wanting in terms of volunteers.
Yeah, what I was going to say was that I wish there were more people like you in institutions of power, like the government and the police, and that there must be people like you that are honest, who know what's going on is wrong, but they're turning a blind eye to survive. Only they're surviving for money, aren't they?
Mm.
And power.
Yeah, I mean, in the microcosm of the prison wing, it's like the people who really want to attain the kind of the jobs with the soft power, the servery, the what is it, the store cupboard and everything like that. It's there's people who really go after it, and will manipulate others and try and screw other people, like basically in order to, for them to succeed, they will take from others. And then, but I think I was quite an aberration in that I was brought into these roles purely because I was just a nice guy who everyone got along with. And it's like, I don't think that's typical at all. You know, as we clearly saw, I mean, whenever I was on servery, though, the people working there alongside me were the kind of heads of the soft power. And I was the odd one out in that really, you know, I wasn't dealing, you know, whether drugs or vapes or I wasn't, you know, committing violence on other prisoners or anything like that. So it was quite odd. So, and for the most part in society, generally the nice guys don't elevate to these positions of power. I mean, God, how many political dramas have we seen where it's like the machinations behind the scenes are just so cutthroat in order for someone to get, you know, to be, what's it, Minister for Energy, you know, so something that really shouldn't require it, but it's like it's really cutthroat game, and that eliminates people like me because I'm not willing to. It's like, yeah, you're gonna have to, you know, release this dirt on this guy, we're gonna tell this guy's wife he's cheating on her and that's gonna ruin him. It's like, and then slowly you'll climb that ladder to power. The way power works, it's like, no, it's generally it's some really cutthroat people. And even if you get nice guys at the top, all it's going to take is a small cadre of some really cutthroat dudes, and they'll really quickly usurp it. You know, that's partly why I think Mark is a fantastic leader, is because it's like, while he is a good guy, he also knows when to cut the knees out from someone.
Oh, thank you.
Yeah. Even the thing at the end of the book you were talking about, where you accidentally knocked the telly over in your cell, and you thought, right, I'm going to just say that someone came in my cell and smashed it up, and then when he told the prison officer, you couldn't live with yourself, and you actually told him the truth, and he went, yeah, just go back to the original story, so you didn't have to pay for a new telly out of your meagre funds. I thought, yeah, Sam, yeah, you're a hero. I would have done the same, actually, but I would. But yeah, I thought, yeah, you didn't lose your moral compass even then.
Yeah, well, I mean, the fact that I did lie in the first place would imply that I'd kind of abandoned my moral compass and then basically bottled it. But yeah, it's like, I just couldn't. I did feel, and I still feel deeply ashamed that it's like I did that and just went, it's like, what wasn't me, Gov? And it was like, oh, I should have just said, but thankfully the officer was a friendly one. I wouldn't say friend, but a friendly one, who helped out. But yeah, that was that again with the diary thing. It's like, I've got to be accountable, and it's like, I put that in there because it's like, I've been so honest about all the good stuff I've done. I've also, you know, when I've been a bit of a shitbag, I need to put that in as well, you know, just to be honest with myself.
Can I say something really weird about the book? So when I picked it up, I couldn't put it down during the prison sections, and I found the prison sections to be so compelling, and they really are. The sections where you're in prison, you could actually make a film out of it. It's that good. I can't talk about how it moved enough about how it moved me and how you seem to be doing so well in prison. Now, weirdly, when you get released from prison, I found that to be slightly anticlimactic. And the weird thing is, when you get out of prison and you're in the approved premises and you're dealing with the people at probation, you're dealing with people from counter-terror, you're doing your MAPA meetings. Basically, you have to deal with all these different arms of the state. It kind of felt weird because you felt that that would be kind of an upward trajectory. You go to prison, that's the low point. You battle your way through. You come out of prison, you start dealing with people in the real world, you're spending more time with your family. But the bit where you're actually out of prison, which is actually the longer part of your sentence, because you only served about 10 months, didn't you? You served 14 on license. Mm. And weirdly, the bit when you're out on license, I found more frustrating and actually darker than your time in prison. Because when you're in prison, you don't seem to... The people in prison, the other prisoners seem to respect you. The prison staff seem to think you shouldn't be there. The governor was quite friendly toward you and gave you a number of decent jobs, sort of even painting his own office. But then you get out, and at that point, you're not managed by prison officers. You're not surrounded by prisoners. You're managed by all these sort of state apparatchiks that are just the worst people imaginable. They're there, they're working for the state because they actually want to get dangerous prisoners back on the street. But conversely, they want you back in prison. They hate you. And I actually found, and the book sort of split sort of probably about, you know, maybe 60-40, maybe 66-33 in the sort of in the favor of prison time at the approved premises. But from my point of view, I actually found the bit when you're in the approved premises far more depressing and far more hard going. I don't know if anyone else felt that way about the book, but when you get to that section, the way they treated you there was appalling. And they almost tried to torture you more because they had control of your life then than they could when you were in prison.
Oh, yeah. I mean, I was dealing with ideologues once I was out. While I was inside, I was dealing with people who were very, the realists. They're dealing with murderers, rapists, and everything like that. So there's really no place for ideology within that. But yeah, like I say, it's like when you're in prison, everything is such a battle. It's like, you know, you're going through a 20-round boxing match running on pure adrenaline. And then all of a sudden you get released out onto probation under such strict restrictions that it's then like, all right, now you're going to play chess solidly for 14 months. And it's just absolutely draining. So it's like that feeling you get while reading it of the depression, the frustration, everything, that is how I felt as well. And why I also kind of fell out of love with writing around, 7-8 months out. In the kind of July time, where I kind of retired the diary, because it's like every week was just the thing of relevance to talk about. Because I didn't want to talk about what I was doing with the kids, you know, Laura, regular life stuff. I wanted it to be politically relevant. It's like we're just recycling the same conversations week in, week out with the counterterrorism prevent officers, with the probation team, and there's really nothing standing out here. So it's like to string this out where it would have been, you know, like 60-40 in favor of the license time. It's like, well, I didn't want the majority of the book to just be this kind of rigmarole of like week in, week out. It's like, oh, he presented the same arguments this week. I presented the same retorts. And it's like I was depressed. And I didn't realize how depressed I was until kind of release on March 1st of this year. That just the constant kind of beatings and like rhetorical beatings that you just constantly getting hammered with. And then on top of that, you can't speak to your friends because you're not allowed to speak to anyone. You can't go online and, you know, laugh at some funny memes or anything about what's going on at the moment around the world or anything. It's like, it really was. I basically shut myself down to my immediate family and concentrated on kind of trying to rebuild the relationship with my children. But that wasn't what I wanted to make the book about. So it's yeah, by, I think it was July, I just kind of sat the diary down and I swear it's like, I've got nothing to write about here. You know, whereas in prison, it seemed like every day something was happening. Something completely out of the ordinary for my world and for the world of, I think, the majority of readers as well.
Can I just ask a question on that vein? Because the kind of ideological pressure that the state was putting on you after your release, when you're in the housing approved, what was it called? The AP. Is there anything that you can do or say? I mean, obviously you could do criminal acts that would send you back to prison, but is there anything you can say about the case or say about your time in prison now where they could collar you again in regards to your conviction or your time in prison? Or is it, and now that you've served your time, there's nothing you can disclose or talk about or discuss on the stream that would see you collared and handed back over to, you know, probation services or the criminal justice system?
No, I mean, they haven't got any sort of restrictions on me now. I'd have to break a whole new law, I guess, in order to face a further conviction. But it wouldn't be kind of like, oh, we did you for this and we're going to take you back in for it. It's like I'm completely past that now, thankfully. But for that 14 months, you know, if I'd basically posted anything online, you know, done any sort of stream, basically associated with anyone within the kind of wider scene. I think one of my restrictions was that I can't radicalize people or something. So it's like, you know, where's the line on that? It's like, you know, the kind of conversations you have regularly on like a PWR, it's like, well, would that breach it? So during those 14 months, yeah, I literally couldn't do anything. However, now I'm completely free to do whatever, and the devices that had access to the 100-handers Telegram channel has been destroyed by the police, so there's no access to that at all, so there's no way I could kind of revive it and then have them come and arrest me and be like, you've carried on doing it. It's like, no, it's completely dead now. I think it's still there. I think there's a message on the Telegram channel that's been going on for about 5 years now saying it's about to get deleted if it doesn't get logged into, but it just carries on being there, which is funny, really, like all the effort they went to shut me down and it's like in the end it's just ended up there, you know, for posterity.
And one of the things that stuck out to me when in the latter part of the book where you're talking to I can't remember his name now, not Dylan, the other one,
Dick
Richard,
yeah, the probation Dick, guy,
was it seemed to be the assumption of these types of people that people like you or people like me are like prone to fly into a violent rage at the sight of like non-white people, and it's a risk. They seem to assume that it was a risk you being around, like it was like seeing a non-white person, and that it's confounding to them that there's like a meta, like political ideology, and it's not just this kind of like primate racism or primate anger and rage. It's just going to take over the moment you see someone who's not white.
Yeah, I mean, it's part of it's their training, you know, via the media and political apparatus. So it's like, here's how these people work. And, you know, it's, well, yeah, it's basically a parody, isn't it? You know, we've seen from a couple of recent attempts to kind of dramatize the far right, and it is just people who have no self-control, don't really have much ideological foundations to their thinking. It's just kind of like, it's like, I just bloody hate them, and if I see them, I'm going to hit them. And it's like, that's not what this thing is made up of. It's like,
that's why they found such catharsis in punishing the Southport rioters, because they seem to see in them something of what we're talking about. Where
these non-political
actors who are angry about something have gone out and seemingly like done, you know, violence in the kind of meanest terms, you know, throwing cans at a migrant hotel or something. So, and here we have it. Here's the big bad. This is what this all means. It's just attacking anything that's related to like brown people, non-white people, you know, on site because you're angry.
Yeah, and they're the ones who essentially orchestrated this situation. It's like you've cut the knees out of every political organization that has attempted to advocate for the white British people, and you've vilified it, you've destroyed them, and then it's like, and then when people go like, well, there's literally no political avenue for me to go down, I'm gonna kick off at this protest, you then go, it's like, see, we knew it all along. And it's like, no, you've backed these people into a corner and given them no other option than to physically express themselves because they're so frustrated, and you're giving them just no route out of this. So what do you expect to happen? And, you know, what they'll claim, it's like, well, you know, there's always option. It's like, no, you're literally taking away every option to them. And it's now to the point where, like, purely based on time and demographics, there's no political option. So it's like, of course, some people are going to kick off.
Missing an important step. I've got to cut in here. You're missing an important step here. What they hope people do is they hope that people are so vilified and that all political things are taken off the table. And they believe that will send people back home and they'll do nothing, because these people are fundamentally cowardly people by their nature. So they believe that like Dick from probation, he's the kind of guy that if you told him he could no longer vote for Labour or the Lib Dems, and the state were like, look, you can't vote for them anymore, you know, we're the state and you can't vote for them, he'd be like, well, if I can't vote for them, I'll just have to go home and sit quietly and wait until the state says I can vote for them again. Whereas he doesn't understand that normal people, when backed into that corner, will react in an angry manner. They can't comprehend normal people, because they don't feel the normal range of emotions that we do, because they are largely cowardly, effeminate men that don't understand natural masculine responses.
Mm. Yeah, and which is why the arguments with Dick at probation always boil down to, it's like, yeah, but have you tried not caring? Which is just anathema. I can't imagine not caring. And I think there's a huge amount of people in this country who can't imagine not caring about these things. But that seems to be what is required of us in order to reach this kind of multicultural utopia that they keep promising in the future, is that everyone just stop caring about these things. And if you did stop caring, then I imagine things seem pretty good. But that's just, like Mark said, it's not human nature. This whole thing is anti-human. Whether it's importing millions of people who have no earthly reason to be living next to you, right there, it's all just a complete experiment, and they want to see if they can get away with it, and it's clearly not working. And like you say, they just hope everyone just kind of sits at home and twiddles their thumbs. And that's just not the way people work. And they haven't got a solution for that. They haven't got a way out. They've only got one tool in their tool belt, and it's a hammer, and they just use it to crush dissent, which is why after the Southport thing, absolutely nothing was done to address the root of the problem. Instead, they just put the lid back on that pressure cooker to cook some more. So the next time something happens, I think we'll see exactly the same thing happen again, further unrest.
But you know what I wanted to say? The other ethnic groups, they're okay to kick off. They kick off and they, you know, these riots and things that have happened all over the country. Historically, Toxteth is one that's in my head from a long time ago. And, all those riots where they literally burned their area down. And the result for them was always that they got what they wanted. You know, they get new community centres and everything rebuilt. And so that our indigenous population see these ethnics kicking off, getting everything, getting off with it, and they think, well, yeah, we'll kick off now. Only they haven't clicked that we can't.
It's because these non-white groups are essentially the client groups of power. We're not the client group, so when we have a problem, they don't feel any need to address our issues. Whereas with these other groups, it's like, well, no, we essentially serve you. So, if you've got an issue, we'll bend over backwards to fix it, whatever it may be. And it's also the other thing where it's kind of like, the state was planning on doing it anyway, just maybe not as quickly as these ethnic groups wanted. So it's kind of like, it's like, oh, you've kicked off. It's like, well, we had that slated for 3 years from now, but I suppose we can do it now, or, whatever you want. But for us, it's just what the solutions we want are the complete opposite to what they want. So they're never going to address our concerns purely because we kick off, which I think just leads to further frustrations where people ask, it's like, well, what can be done? Which leads to, down pretty depressing avenues, because it feels like we're completely up against a brick wall here.
Yeah, which I, just as an aside, I think is important for people to understand, rather than come in full of piss and vinegar and be like, we're going to change the world and we're doing it now. And I don't know, maybe you've changed since the book was published, but have your thoughts on Rupert Lowe changed? Because you were pretty positive and optimistic about Rupert Lowe and the split, the Restore Party splitting off from Reform. I don't want to drag the stream into a, Restore conversation.
I've definitely become a bit more circumspect. Having access to the internet helps. prior to that, it was kind of like, I've heard about this happening. That sounds like a positive move. The more you read, and it's like, the kind of natural pessimism from nationalism, we kind of go, it's like, sure. I've been burned before. I feel like I'm being burned again, like kind of thing. But I think as well, I think the issue with Rupert is he isn't an ideologue in this thing. He's essentially kind of like a boomer who's had enough. And that I don't think is necessarily going to be strong enough to counteract the kind of forces he's going to be pushing up against. I know he's got a kind of younger cadre around him, but it's a lot of guys I really haven't seen much from. So I can't speak to how, good they are and how strong they'll be going forward. I'm naturally optimistic, so I hope for the best, prepare for the worst kind of thing.
Well, if I had one critique of the book, it's that the majority of the book is kind of evergreen and probably timeless and could be picked up at any stage, in the next 20, 30, 40 years and be a compelling read about the kind of your journey through the legal system and through prison. But I think the Rupert Lowe stuff, is already, as I was reading it this weekend, I was already kind of down on it, like, oh no, this is out of date already.
This is going to be bad. Yeah, I mean, I think what I was talking about in regards to Restore at the very end there, literally written, March. Well, no, I released the pre-order for the book on March 1st, so I'll have been pretty much ready then. So it must have been about the time he launched, which is like, was it February 28th or something like that. So it was literally completely fresh out of the box there. But what I saw was that there's a hell of a lot of support for essentially what's going to be coming down that and the line, which is ethnic sectarianism. And the problem is that it's like all that support is going to be scattered all over the country. And really what we want to be looking at is kind of tighter communities to consolidate that support. Similar to what we see with the ethnic kind of communities we have now, where it's like they basically sit within a political boundary and dominate it. And I think that's something that we're all going to have to take very seriously in going forward, is that every group is going to be out for themselves, and white people can't continue to split themselves between 5-6 different parties. It's going to have to be, okay, who's the white party, you know, or the white candidate, and we vote for that guy to enact power and try and get a little slice of the pie for ourselves as this democracy kind of just deteriorates into an ethnic headcount.
So just, you brought up one more thing. I'm sorry. I know I'm monopolizing the time here. We talked about, you said the word democracy, and I think we all understand that it's a rigged game, right? It doesn't, you know, we can't make progress, partly because the way the system's set up, democracy is, you know, designed to not give people like us what we want. But that kind of shone through in the latter part of the book, where you're arguing with this guy, this Dick, the probation officer, who by all rights, you should have been able to just like absolutely just go off at him and get as mad and give him the verbal tongue lashing and, you know, just slap him down and call him all the names under the sun. But you couldn't, because your hands were tied behind your back and you had to operate in this system where you it's basically a losing game to talk to this guy, and you have to kind of engage him inside the system where you can't tell him what he needs to hear or what he deserves to hear, and you can't treat him the way he deserves to be treated. And I kind of felt the same way about when your musings on the political system. It's kind of like the micro and macro for democracy, in the way you had to tread lightly and operate within certain rules when you were talking to the probation officer.
Yeah, because it feels like obviously Mark's been in this for so long now, but it's like we're having the same conversations and arguments that we've been
having for years
now, decades. And it's like the argument has been settled, but the problem is we don't have a media pulpit. We don't have any political power. And it's like, so it doesn't matter if we've won the argument, because we're going to lose the game. And dealing with the probation officer was like, where it was just kind of like the power dynamic there was one where it's kind of like the argument has been won, but you know, you're the one who decides to call time and essentially decides the rules of the bout and everything. And it's like it's this madness. And on a wider political scale, that's the kind of situation we're in, where it's like clearly what's the prevailing kind of power is just built on lies, and is completely, you know, messing everything up. But there's just no other option. We can't seem to get a foot in the door. I think probably right on my release was the kind of peak of my optimism, that it's like, oh yeah, things are going to change. And then it's like rapidly I've kind of gone downhill, where I've gone, it's like, oh, it's like things are still in very much the same situation they were when I went away.
Look, I've got to say this, and I know this is going off topic. I'll do the super chats in a second. I'll read them out. There's no, I don't think there's actually questions. I think they're just sort of more statements. If anyone wants to make a super chat, they can, and then we'll round it up. This could be a good maybe chat for us guys when we're doing like the A team or something. But one thing that never fails to disappoint me is people's willingness to go running back to the political system. And the thing that sort of really got me recently in terms of the way people think, the way people act, is with this Rupert Lowe thing, it wasn't long ago that people were saying another party was going to be, oh, you know, this is the last chance and this party. But I'm not going to bother naming. Everyone knows what I'm talking about. There were set of idiots. They're going to win. And I said, no, they're not. I said, this other party that we're not naming, I said, they haven't got a hope in hell of winning. I said, it's too late for a new party to just be established and to steamroller everything. And that was proved to be correct. And now everyone's like, oh, Rupert Lowe's going to do it. Rupert Lowe's going to do it. There's going to be complete salvation here. You know, Rupert's going to save us. And I'm thinking to myself, well, how many times have I heard that somebody's going to save us? How many times have the public run into different people's arms, whether it's sort of Thatcher, whether it was Boris Johnson, multiple times to Nigel Farage, now Rupert Lowe. And we're watching the demographics change at the quickest rate they've ever changed. But now everyone's like, yeah, we're going to do it again. And you're sort of thinking to yourself, how many times are people going to run towards these people, these guys put on a pedestal, and think it's all going to be saved that way? And obviously I don't have an answer, because I think it's going to be infinite. I think these people will keep making the same mistake again and again. And I've been sort of more lukewarm on the Rupert Lowe issue than anyone else. I haven't been negative, but I've been lukewarm on it, because to this date, Rupert Lowe is yet to define himself. And that's the really worrying thing. Rupert Lowe's party is a one-man operation. It's the whim of Rupert Lowe, which is fine. Okay, it's his party. But until he's defined what his party is, I'm not getting too excited, because I can see in 6 months' time the big announcement. Rupert Lowe sits down with Tommy Robinson and, you know, this Israeli some Israeli influencer for an epic round table about bringing people together to do what's right. And most of the conversation will be, how can we ensure Britain stands behind Israel? I've got this nagging worry that that's where this is all going to go. And I don't want to be the guy that's always pouring cold water on people's happiness or saying, look, it's not going to work. But I just can't see it working. And I think that fundamentally, getting to power for a nationalist group in this country happens in several phases. And the first phase, unfortunately, has to always be the complete destruction of the Conservative Party. And I think what we're going to see as a result of Rupert Lowe is Reform and Restore fighting each other to a standstill, and their battle for the populist right will see both Labour become a two-term regime. They'll get in for a second term, but I think we will see the Conservatives fare better than they would have done, because of the nature of the two-party system that we live under. I think this is the issue. And my answer has always been the same. We have to start looking at Britain and say, we need to start living together. I'm not saying what Woodland is doing is wrong. I think buying the land is amazing, but we have to have a proper solution where we move to the same area. Not everyone's going to be able to go and live on like a patch of land in a caravan or cabin. That's not suitable for most people. I know it's probably not suitable for you, Sam, because you've got kids. I'm not sure whether Natty would want to live in a, Natty would be able to convince Mrs. Natty, to go and live in a caravan or in a cabin. We need to start targeting towns and eventually cities that we can move to, cluster in, take over, and build our own intentional communities. Take over the shops, take over the old town centres, the youth centres, the churches. We need to take it all over, and these places need to be our places. Then we need to elect our own officials. So, you know, we take over, you know, we'll call it Town X, And then we're all the counsellors in Town X. Town X is completely run by our people. And eventually the MP for Town X is one of our people. And as the country starts to look more like Northern Ireland, in terms of it being a multi-ethnic sectarian nation, we within that country have our own representation. The worst thing that could possibly happen to us as a people is that we look at this going forward. We stay where we are. We become a minority uniformly across the country. And whilst every other group has representation and every other group has a place to cluster, we're the only ones that don't. And the reason we don't is because we sat on our arses waiting for somebody like Rupert Lowe to come and save us. I don't know if that chimes with anyone, but that's my concern.
Yeah, that's my general feeling right now. It's like we're going to burn a bit more time that we could be using for other things. So I'm going to keep a toe in restore, you know, but it's like generally I think we were on the right plan beforehand, before restore. And I just don't want to sink too much energy into what, I mean, Christ, he was fucking tweeting about increasing the motorway speed limit by 10 miles per hour the other day. And it's just like, if you're going to, you know, win this country back or whatever, it's like you've got to be monomaniacal in terms of your goal. Yeah,
a radical 10-mile-an-hour.
Yeah.
Like, very extreme there, Rupert Lowe.
It's like, meanwhile, I'm driving my 98 Corolla at like 60 because it's like...
going to reach 70 miles an hour, let alone 80 miles an hour,
It's Rupert. Like 70, I wish. but yeah, it's and then I mean he had that sit down with a very friendly sit down with Rees-Mogg recently, and it's like, come on. And I think he called himself like he's a true Tory, he's not like a wet Tory. And it's like, I mean, the word Tory should only be spat out of someone's mouth, let alone calling yourself like I'm a true Tory. It's like, Jesus, man, what are we doing?
Look, I'm just going to add, because we have to shut this down in a minute, but I just want to add to this because Sam's just sort of triggered me by saying this. Rees-Mogg is one of the worst.
Rees-Zogg.
He's the one of the worst. And he's one of those Tories that in his perfect world, he would be sat there in his giant mansion with loads of kids that all have stupid names. I bet all his kids have got stupid names. If people want to look them up, I bet they do. But they've got like 8 names, you know, so they'll be kind of like Tarquin, Benjamin, Alfarius, Zogboy, Rees-Mogg, you know, it'd be ridiculous. They'll have the worst names and they'll have loads of these kids and they'll all be sat there in this giant mansion. And he wants to look out at the plantations he owns, at the fields, at the factories that are all, you know, part of the Mogg portfolio. And the people working in them would be a multiracial sea of different colours, ethnicities. But at the end of the day, they'd all walk home singing Rule Britannia, waving little flags, and making sure they pay their taxes. And that's the Britain that Rees-Mogg wants. One where everyone is waving the little flag, completely colourblind, but as long as they wave that little flag, pay their taxes, and the Rees-Mogg family are still like the big barons that own, you know, the whole of Norfolk or Devon or wherever he comes from, you know what I mean? As long as he owns that and no one messes with his property and his family owns everything and those working for them wave the little flags and pay the taxes. That's his idea of Britain. That's Rees-Mogg Britain. That's not the Britain I want. I don't want a Britain where these, you know, snotty-nosed, posh, multiculturalists look down on us and assure us that we're all the same as long as we sing Rule Britannia together and wave the little flag. That to me is a sickening parody of what a European nation should be.
Hear, hear. And, you know, to dogpile and add on that, these people, Rees-Mogg has been in power and he's overseen the transition of a homogenous society into what we live in now. So, you know, whatever his other faults are, which are numerous, and is the fact that he's a Zog boy through and through. The fact that, you know, any Tory who's been in government just deserves nothing but scorn, including Rees-Mogg. And the fact that Lowe is sitting down with his people is shameful.
Right. I made a joke earlier about how badly his children would be named. I'm going to read these children.
I've got it up as well.
Theodore Alfagi. So when I said Alfarius, and that was a 40K name, and that was going to be a joke, but accidentally, I've almost named one of his children. Mary Ann Charlotte Emma, Thomas Wentworth Somerset Dunstan, Anselm Charles Fitzwilliam, Alfred Wolfric Layson Pius, Sixtus Dominic Boniface Christopher. And that last one isn't a joke. I didn't make that up. These are the people, right, that need bullying. Those children need bullying, right? I don't care what anyone says, but they need bullying. Rees-Mogg needed bullying when he was at school. What on earth is going on? They are his children's names. I can't believe it. I mean, guys, can you imagine a world? Well, this is the world that Rees-Mogg and people like Rees-Mogg govern over. It's a horrible world. It's a world where normal white people suffer on a daily basis. So him and his stupid, like, six-name children, you know, can live like little Lord Fauntleroy looking down their nose at us. And you're right. The worst thing about these absolute POSs is they governed over us for decades and decades, got us in this mess. And now they sit down talking about how to upend the establishment. They are the establishment. Oh my God. Right. Let's do the super chats and then we'll round things up. Unless anyone else wants to comment on those names, you couldn't have made. I mean, if the name I made up was probably less stupid than some of those names. Unbelievable. Right. My Lord. Jack 203 gave $30. Thank you so much. Said nobody does it better, Mark. Or nobody does it better than Mark. Thank you so much. I almost made that super chat less good than it was. Thank you. Solar Mass kept his 2-month subscriber streak going for $15. Thank you so much. Blade Man gave $3. Thank you so much. Said I ordered my copy of the book from the oldspeakbookshop.co.uk. It's a small independent right wing bookshop. If you can support local nationalist businesses like this one, please do. Hail Sam and hail Mark. Thank you very much. Pig Beanis, which I almost misread every time it comes up, gave $3. Thank you so much. And said, welcome back, Sam. Have one on me. Thank you very much. Baba2 gave $20. Thank you so much. And said, this gift is for Sam. Gives me great joy to contribute to and give moral support to those who have sacrificed for our people. Hail Sam. Much respect from David Whiteaxe to Sam. Well, thank you so much. And Baba2 gave another $20. Thank you very much. And said, perhaps the enemy will win. Perhaps we're doomed for multicultural degeneration into oblivion. Perhaps. But I have determined to fight and to stand with those of my brothers who do. Hail our folk. Well, thank you so much. And I agree. We all are going to stand and fight to the last. Hazelnut 3000 gave $10. Thank you so much. It's a great book. Read Sam and Mark's now. Both great reads. Hope everything goes well for you now, Sam. And they leave you alone. I agree. And thank you for everyone who super chatted. If you want to super chat or donate via crypto, you can do so at any time. So let's sum up what we think about the book, then give Sam the final word. We'll go Natty, Aunt Sally, me, then Sam. Let's go for it, guys.
Yeah, buy the book. It's a compelling narrative. Sam is a great man and his family deserves your support. So if you're on the fence about buying it, then you should. And further to that, I am proud to call Sam Melia a friend, and long may that continue.
I mean, it's a great book, and I'm not just saying that. It really was a great book. Sam's very talented, a talented writer, and it's an easy read. It's just fascinating. It's a different world to anything that I've ever known, anything I've ever read. It's a really, really good book, and I recommend it highly. And thank you, Sam, for writing it. It's good to have read it that at the time we went in, morale went down, I think, for everybody. And then there was this big buzz, the letter writing campaigns and the demos outside the prisons. And then I'm reading you at the time, writing it at the time when we were all doing that, and it was just, I don't know, it's just it was like I was part of it, but I wasn't part of it, if you know what I mean. It's a really good book anyway. Thank you, Sam. I hope you write more books. You should do. Okay.
Well, I want to say this. We've had a lot of books on Book Club, and I'm not sure what episode it is of Book Club, but there's been a fair few. And to say this is one of the best books we've had on Book Club is an understatement. It's absolutely magnificent. And from someone who isn't an author, from someone who isn't a professor or a doctor or somebody who writes for a living, that's really high praise. And I can't praise this book enough. The book takes you on an emotional journey, a journey where a man who was doing something which he thought was just, well, no one's going to notice this. I'm going to do my best. This is the best idea I can come up with. A man who didn't want to be noticed was thrust into the limelight. And that man, through everything they did to him, not only was he not broken, not only did he hold his nerve, but he brought joy, happiness, and hope to everybody he met along the way. And throughout moments that would have broken most men, he continued to inspire people, both the prisoners that he was incarcerated with, his family, who love him dearly, his friends, but also millions of people all over the world, all over the Western world. People were cheering him on, and rightfully so. Sam isn't just a hero. Sam truly is the best of us. Sam is a man that throughout all of this has proved his dedication, his loyalty, and that his heart is bigger and stronger than anything the system could throw at him. This book comes with my highest recommendation. It truly is something that everyone should read and treasure. I've had it by my bedside for the last couple of weeks. I haven't been able to put it down. It's so compelling. And if you do one thing, if you buy one book, if you buy one piece of nationalist merchandise this year, make it this book. You won't be disappointed. Sam, you're the man of the hour. You deserve all the high praise you've received tonight. I could have made this stream 3 or 4 hours because it's so fun talking to you about this. It's brilliant being able to go through this with you because the book is such a journey and it's so personal. When you read it, you hear you speaking, you feel every bit of it, but you're the man of the hour. Give us your final thoughts and then we'll shut it down.
I'd like to thank everyone for their kind words and thank everyone for all the support I received while I was inside as well. Every letter was like a lifeline to remind me that I wasn't alone in there, and it really was appreciated. Thank you for the support since I've been out as well. It's been absolutely huge. The book sold has sold far better than I ever expected, and so many well wishes from everyone. I'm planning on just continuing as I have been, doing the best I can for nationalism for our people, and I hope that the experiences that I detailed in that book inspire more people to realize that it's like they can stand up as well. And you don't have to be, you know, the master debater or the big public guy or anything. We can all make a small difference, and it's all on us to make that small difference as well, because without that, then we are surely lost.
Well, thank you. Thank you to Natty. Thank you to Sam. Thank you to Aunt Sally. We've had a great night tonight. Thank you to everyone who joined us and everyone who donated so generously. We will be back next month with Sasha Rossmuller's book, or the English version of Sasha Rossmuller's next book. So the book club is back, or so it seems.
I am reading that right now. It's really good.
Well, I'm really looking forward to getting my copy. I've got to say this. Keith Woods has got a new book out as well, so I might reach out to Keith as well. So as long as there's actually good books to review, we're going to keep doing it. Anyway, thank you to everyone. I really appreciate all those who donated. If you want to donate when I'm not online, if you're watching this on replay, that's really appreciated too. I have now got a Substack. Please check that out. You can subscribe to me over on there too if you prefer that. And we will see you on Wednesday, hopefully, for Patriotic Weekly Review. Have a great weekend, whatever left of it. I love you all. I'll see you all again soon. Thank you, everybody. Good night.